Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Well, hi everybody, and well, welcome to another Kings of Anglia special podcast with myself, Mike Bacon, and well, I'm great to chat to a very special guy here about a very special season in Ipswich Town's history. We'll get onto that in a minute, because it's 30 years ago this year that that Town won the old, what was the second division, the current championship, if you like, and catapulted themselves into the premiership. A tremendous achievement, the inaugural premiership as well, the first year of the premiership. A 1-1 draw at Oxford, secured promotion to the top flight in April 1992. Fantastic achievement by the Blues, who've obviously had some great seasons, but this was right up there with one of them. And, well, one man who played every single game that season for the Blues on their way to the title. Well, we all know this guy, a larger-than-life character and a fantastic goalkeeper. I think he was about 6'10" when I last heard, but he's probably shrunk a little bit to 6'6" or whatever. Look, it's Craig Forrest. He played more than 300 times for Town and enjoyed some great times. And it's a treat that he's over there in Canberra with his Ipswich Town shirts, if you're watching this on video. Craig Forrest, what can I say? It's great to see you.
Well, thanks for having me on, Mike. It really is always a treat to talk about Ipswich Town. It's never a hardship whatsoever. So I thought I would dust off the old jersey and pull out. I can't remember what year this one was, actually, quite honestly.
Well, we'll have some experts watching this who know that exactly. My friend Andy Warren probably being one of them. But
But it was good. Yeah, great times. Right from when I was 16, when I arrived, and Bobby Ferguson was just taking over from Bobby Robson, and we're still in the top flight. My first match I ever saw was Manchester United at home with Ipswich. Gary Bailey was playing in net. You know, the place was just incredibly, should I say, like, it made a decision in my life that I was like, this is really what I want to do. I just could not believe what I was watching and seeing, and watching Ipswich Town play at that level was just absolutely special. It really was. And I was caught, and I was really bitten by the club from that moment on.
I was going to say, because, I mean, you came over to England. You know, how did that all come about? How on earth and why Ipswich Town? How on earth did that all come about? I mean, you're miles away there in Canada, where obviously you are today. And how on earth did Ipswich Town come about?
Yeah, I was even further away. I was in Vancouver, which is another four and a half hour flight west of here in Toronto. So it was really about, you know, you need a certain amount of luck and you need support. I had that. My family was amazing. My dad was great, supporting that and supporting me through development and whatnot. But there was a guy called Phil Trenter, the Trenter family is all from Ipswich. He was from Ipswich. He played in the Ipswich youth team back in the day. There was a Canadian as well, Bruce Twomley, who I believe played a couple of appearances, had a really bad leg break when he was under Bobby Robson, I believe. So he ended up coming over to play in the North American Soccer League. I think the club with the past foreigners, even Franz Tyson and Arnold Muren and guys like that, played a role with the club even being out in rural Ipswich. He had a manager, Bobby Robson, who'd done it, and he was one of the first ones to bring him in. And if you remember, I mean, if you remember back at that time, though, there was a lot of, well, can they play in this, in the English league? It's too tough. They're going to get the, you know, life kicked out of them, and, you know, it's not going to work. And wow, how they were wrong. So I think the reaching out to foreign countries or looking for, you know, diamonds in the rough, maybe somewhere else, was something that they were open to more than maybe other clubs. So Phil Trenter had a connection with Ron Gray, the old chief scout, legendary Ron Gray. You got a connection, said, got somebody I think you'd like to look at, worth having a look at. And Ron said, yeah, if he's willing to pay his own flight over and come over, we'll have him. So that's what I did, and showed up at Heathrow with everything I owned, 16 years of age, made my way up the Liverpool Street, and that was another story, trying to find my way there. And then Ron picked me up at Ipswich train station, God bless him. And then I went right to St. Leonard's Road in Ipswich.
Yeah, I know. I know St. Leonard's Road. It's off Nacton Road, I think.
That's right. And my old landlady, Mrs. Beryl Bond, I was straight to her place, and that's where I ended up staying for a couple years in my digs. She was a massive part of, you know, looking after me, my homesickness, because I mean, it's not like we can do what we can do now and chat online and things like that. It was about 50p a minute to phone in 1984 to phone Canada. So my landlady actually had a lock on the phone, so I could, just in case you want to phone home, you need the key. Nuts, right?
The club didn't pay her that much to keep you.
No, well, I was on £25 a week when I signed. And Mrs. Bond was getting £35 a week for keeping me. So she had to pay me, or sort of feed me with that money. And then, you know, I don't think she was doing it for the money. I really don't. I think she just really enjoyed having guys around. And there was a few other players that went through her place too, back then. But yeah, she was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And she was my second mom.
It was quite daunting. Quite a daunting move at 16 years old, Craig, just to fly across the other side of the world to somewhere you didn't really know. You're quite determined. You were very determined to want to be a footballer.
It was. School wasn't something that was something that I really enjoyed. I think I definitely had ADD, and I just could not concentrate long enough on anything. And I think that's why football was great, because there's always something going on and balls coming at you and everything else. So then having to leave before the end of school here, because the graduation would have been a year later, was important. And it was also great advice to get over there as early as you can, because they're going to sign you on potential, as opposed to if you go a year later, a couple of years, you're going to have to be almost the finished product or somewhat close to it. So that was important. And it certainly was part of it, because I certainly wasn't even close to the finished product. And I had a hell of a time with ball striking at 16. I think my body was, I was 6'5". I think my body was still trying to catch up to me. And that was the last thing that really came, but it was a process. And it was a wonderful time. And we also had a very good youth team. You know, Dalian Atkinson, Jason Dizell was part of that. Chris Kwame was part of that as well. And, you know, we were very successful, went over to France, played in a tournament with Barcelona and Inter Milan, AC Milan, Glasgow Rangers were there, Dinamo Kiev, Santiago de Chile. They're all over the world. And Porto, Benfica, we ended up beating Porto in the final. And just, had a magnificent... The only reason why we ended up there, quite honestly, was because for some reason Arsenal pulled out, and they only wanted, like, you know, the top names, if you like, you know. And Ipswich, although still coming out of the UEFA Cup years and the success of that, were sort of, okay, we'll phone Ipswich. Do they want to come to this tournament? So that's how we ended up there as a youth team, and with Pete Trevivian as a coach, who was also another great coach. For Ipswich at youth level, man, he was so good with the younger generation and the guys, and you know, his honesty and just a true gentleman was certainly a big part of my development too, as a player and as a person.
You talked about some of the players there, of course. We talk about the 92 season, because a lot of those players featured in that strongly. A good youth was. Ipswich were born on youth around that time, and through the 70s and the 80s, weren't they?
Absolutely. It was all about that. And I think, you know, that's how a club in a town the size of Ipswich could compete. If you had the right resources and the right coaches and the right scouting system, you could actually do it. days have changed, times have changed, as we know. I mean, looking at Ipswich even recently, you know, the likes of the young Mexican Canadian lad that was there, trying to remember his name, he's at Arsenal now. So he came over as a 12-year-old Ipswich.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he ends up being sold to Arsenal at 17 or 16, whatever, for $500,000, I think, or something like that. So you get to these situations where the clubs need the money. But back in the day, Terry Butcher, George Burley, John Wark, Craig Forrest, we're all going to move into the first team. We're going to spend that time. We're going to be, and then maybe someone is going to come and pick the odd one away from you, as we saw with Ipswich in their heyday when, you know, Man United, Arsenal started to do the same to us then. But at least you had a chance to have some time with them and be successful with that group. So now it's difficult to compete. It really is. And unless you're owned by an oil state or, you know, a billionaire American, it's really, really difficult. And they're looking for big market teams.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Well, so going back to you, so there you were, Craig, 16 years old, that you're going through, obviously, don't know your youth. I suppose it's like a YTS scheme, I suppose you were there in those type of days. That's what it's called or something like that. Did you, so your debut, so you must, obviously you remember your debut and well, how did it all come about? What can you, obviously, you remember it well?
Yeah, I remember it really well. And before that, because I'd gone on loan to Colchester for a couple months. And that was great because it was, you know, 20 miles down the road. Charlie Woods and the rest of the coaching staff could get down there and watch me play. Sometimes the crowds weren't very big. You know, remember old Lair Road there?
Yes, of course. Everyone remembers Lair Road. What a fantastic old crowd.
Yeah. It was so bad, it was good.
I always thought Lair Road had one of the best home advantages because you were on top of the players and the ground was always falling apart around you. But it was just a brilliant football ground. Anyone who didn't go there missed a treat.
Yeah, no, it's true. It really was. And even the manager's office was actually literally over top of Lair Road. Like yes. It was that close. And sometimes the hot water worked and sometimes it didn't. And the dressing room, the corners were always dirty. It was quite something. And we get changed there and then go off to a military base to train, which the pitch was just awful. Roger Brown, I believe, was the manager then. So anyway, playing in the fourth tier, get there down there with Colchester, it goes really well. I had a fantastic time. It was a lot of pressure, but then it was also exciting because I was like, well, even at that age, I was like, I played in the football system. Like I'm just, I've played in the league system and that alone, like I was like, wow, that was great. And so I had 2 months there because they extended it to 2 months, right to the end of the season. And we were close to pushing for the playoffs and making a run that way. And then sort of the loan spell ended and I went back to Ipswich and it was the end of the season, went home to Vancouver for a few weeks, got a call from, the club saying that they'd sold John Holsworth and we're going to put you in as a starting goalkeeper next year. So I was like, whoa,
it must have been quite a thrill to hear that.
It was. And then on the other hand, I wish maybe they told me a little bit closer to like a couple of weeks later because I couldn't think of anything else. I was in my backyard throwing the ball off the side of the house and I was like starting to get ready already.
how old were you then, Craig? Were you about 20 years old?
Yeah, 19, 20.
Yeah. Gosh, tremendous.
Like yeah, and so it was actually Stoke away.
Right.
Yeah, and I remember that well. Even, you know, Romeo Zondervan was great and support and Frank Yallop and the guys and, yeah, I remember it incredibly well. I remember the dressing room. I remember going out in the pitch. I remember the crowd or going to the away crowd for the very first time and that experience. And, yeah amazing. And we drew 2-2, did okay. And, so it was just about trying to keep your spot and do a good job and continue with that. So they were patient with me as well. I mean, made a few mistakes here and there, but they were really patient. And I think the guys in front of me were great too. Like I said, Romeo and Frank and those types of guys were incredibly supportive and always say, we got your back. We got your back. Don't worry about it. Just save shots.
Yeah. And of course, Ipswich were out of the Premier. Well, it wasn't the Premier League then, was it? It was Division One. Ipswich were then back in Division Two then for most of this time.
That's right.
But slowly heading back towards the time we really want to enjoy talking about, which was that 91-92 season. Ipswich had started to knock on the door of getting back up. But before we talk about the season a little bit, of course, it was the season before the Premiership. It was the inaugural Premiership. Whoever won the second division that season was going to go not just in Division One. Division One was no more. It's going to be the Premiership. And of course, we know the Premier League today. I mean, it's just extraordinary, huge, thing. But back then, it was obviously new. We didn't know really much about it. But mm-hmm. So, what was thoughts of you must have known the Premiership was the holy grail of promotion that season 91-92.
Well, we didn't know the Premier League was the Holy Grail. What we did know was the top flight was.
Yeah.
Really was nothing for the players around that time than a name change. Okay, you're going to call it the Premier League and first, second, third division. And, it didn't really matter to us. I think what happened, the Premier League evolved into something on its own. And you talk about records and it's the Premier League records and this, that, and the other, which is also a little disappointing for the past generations, because it's like, hold on a minute. Like, we had top class Premiership football years before the Premier League started as well, and a lot of that is kind of missed. So there was a power struggle. We know the whole situation with that. I mean, it certainly created a lot more money for the top flight. And I think it hurt some of the lower divisions for sure. And, we saw the attempt at the Super League in Europe this past year, which was a scary thing and something that I'm glad that the general football population and public together basically squashed that. Mm-hmm. And it's not very often that us small guys can squash billionaires' ideas. They're just usually too big to fail. So that was great. But the Premier League was somewhat like that. But we didn't see much more than that. So it was years later when when people brought up the fact that I was one of 13 foreigners that started on opening day. I was first of all taken aback a little bit because I didn't really consider myself as a foreigner. I'd already been there for 8 years. In England, so I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess I am still technically a foreigner, sure, and all right, whatever, but so it was amazing. It turned into something fantastic and certainly something on his own, and it certainly changed from the time 92 to when I actually retired in 2002, just the difference, and certainly that influx of foreign money and foreign players that came into the league for the better or not in some ways. It certainly did from a league's perspective because it's the best league in the world.
You've nicked one of my stats. I hope you're happy with that about the 13 foreigners. I haven't got many stats here, Craig, but that was one of them. I was gonna sit back and I was going to educate yourself and the whole population with this stat. And you've just chucked it out there as though I knew that. Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about how you got. But you're right. You were one of only 13 foreigners who played on the for opening weekend of the Premiership season in 1992. It's extraordinary now when you think of if you find 13 English players in there, you've done well, let alone.
That's right. Yeah, and it wasn't until, I think, the fifth anniversary. I think it was the Sun newspaper reporter. Had phoned up or somebody, I guess he had looked at it and I guess he saw that there was changing and it was 5 years on and now there's, 45 starting in the first day and so on and so on. So it became sort of a thing, but you could look back on what it was on opening day and it was, wow. Yeah. Wow. I had no idea. Yeah. But I guess it was the whole league was primarily, United Kingdom.
Yeah. So going back to Ipswich, that 91-92 season, though, is what we come to talk about, as Craig, very much so. And, of course, that was the season Ipswich Town got promoted to that Premiership. I mean, before the season started, you went on a tour of Finland. Do you remember that? Or is that
what? Oh, yeah.
I've only got that as a note. I don't know if that means anything to you or...
Well, we took many trips over to Scandinavia. We
did actually,
Sweden and Norway and Finland. I think we actually played a game on that tour in Finland at a place called Kemi, which was 60 miles or less from the Arctic Circle. I mean, it was daylight all night long. It was it was quite something to be in that sort of environment, you know. And the same thing goes when in the wintertime, the poor buggers are dark all the time. But wow, that was something. So yeah, a small town in Kemi. Preseason results were never something that truly going to, you know, tell you what the season's going to be like. That's for sure. So we never took them all that seriously. Although we did get rolled over by a few teams in Norway before.
Now, do you remember the first match of the season? And I asked Jason Dazelle this, and he remembered it. It was yesterday. It was apparently a 3-3 draw at Bristol Rovers. I think it might have been at Bristol Rovers. I mean, he just plucked it out of the yes. Oh yeah, I remember that. This then. Do you remember? I mean, it's obviously opening day. Just a game. I thought I'd throw in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now you mentioned, I wouldn't have said no. I would have known that. Now I was saying that, I think, didn't Jason score though in that game?
I think he did. That's probably why he remembered it.
Right. And I let in three. I'm not going to remember that.
Oh, yeah. Apologies. Yeah. Sorry. Should have been a 3-0, but it wasn't. It was a 3-3.
Yeah. That's right.
But we start. Ipswich had a good start to that campaign to this season in 91-92, you know, as we headed towards that, getting into the Premiership. Had a good start to a good feel to it all. By August, I think the top in August, and a few notes here that I've made, I think apart from a loss to Sunderland and Derby, mm-hmm. and then had a really good run around Christmas.
Yeah, but in between time, I think we went into a lull. I don't know if we won a game for 6 or 7 or 8 games, something mm-hmm. like that. It was a terrible spell. And you know, remember, too, I think we're 6 years on from being in the top flight, mm-hmm. right? So the town itself had been down on the football club for a few years. Attendances weren't very good. We were mediocre at best, mid-table. There wasn't a lot of excitement going on. Everybody was – one of the tough parts, actually, about signing with Ipswich at that time, and as opposed to other clubs, when you're coming out of a golden generation, you know, FA Cup, UEFA Cup, challenging for titles, that – amazing group of players, they become almost like it's they're expecting it, they're entitled to keep doing that. Like, why aren't we should be doing this again? So I saw that, and I saw how the players had to deal with it before I got in the first team for the years, because they were relegated, you know, after I was there as a youth player. So I saw the devastating effects of relegation it was for clubs, and just the whole change of what it was for, you know, jobs and people that are getting let go and availability for players and so on and so on. So that was quite a long, you know, agonizing 6 years, you know, mm-hmm. to play in, because we didn't have an awful lot of success. We had a couple cup runs, but it was a lot of doom and gloom around the town. So that season, to put it together as we did, and then we had that good run around Christmas. I think we went 10 unbeaten around then, and then we saw the finish line, and it was in sight. And with John Lyle being our manager, we couldn't have been a better person for it. He was an incredible guy. It's very hard to put in words what type of person. He was like a godfather type figure. He was a gangster type figure. He could be your dad. He could be your friend. He could be your enemy. He, you know, absolute total respect for the man. And then learned an awful lot about West Ham as well through over the years of when, you know, Ron Greenwood, he would talk openly about all that kind of stuff. And if people wanted to listen, he was willing to talk to everybody. So the players had great relationships with him with the utmost respect for the man.
I mean, John Lyle was a heck of a character. And as you say, I mean, he did tremendous things at West Ham. And going back to the start of that season, I think, if I remember right, as you absolutely spot on, that the club was really just drifting, to be honest. It come out of the Premiership and it was just drifting. And I think even going into that season, were Ipswich really one of the favourites to go up and get promoters? I don't believe we were. We're obviously one of the better sides, but I think Newcastle were there, Derby were there, Middlesbrough were there. There were some good sides in there. I don't think anyone expected Ipswich not just to get promoted, but of course win the title. It actually won the title, you know.
Tremendous. Yeah. That was a big thing for us too, because when we're getting to the end, you know, we wanted to win it. We didn't want to finish second. Second got promoted as well. We wanted to actually win the title. Win a trophy, like that's what we're trying to do in the first place, and that is it's a difficult league to win, you know, because there's a lot of parity, and then you get a couple teams. I mean, nowadays you see teams in there, they've got the parachute payments, so they've got this added money for a few years, and some teams take advantage of that very well and manage that, like Norwich have done, you know, become a yo-yo club because they're not tempted to overspend when they get to the Premier League, and that often costs them their spot in the Premier League, but they're, you know, financially sound. So it's a little bit different, but yeah, it was just overall a grind from start to finish. And when we got over the finish line, and I remember we had a chance to clinch, I think it was Bristol City away, and we ended up losing that one 2-1. That was a long drive home. For everybody and the fans, because we took 4,000 or 5,000 down there.
I mean, you're right, Gal. Remember, again, Ipswich Town fans who have always been extraordinary travellers. I mean, you know, the great away support as well as home support were huge then as well. It started off quite quietly, but as it started to snowball, huge amount. I think at South End near the end of the season.
South End, wasn't that? That was amazing. I mean, that little ground is a great little football ground too, right? Yeah. So had that one end zone. It was just bonkers in there. I remember there was balloons flying around and everything else. Shit, it was a lot of fun. Yeah. I mean,
interestingly, South End and Cambridge United, funny enough, were another. They were good. They were both East Anglian sides and were both up there, which, I mean, South End are non-league now. It's just extraordinary, you know.
And
Cambridge is the same league as Ipswich. But at the time, I mean, Cambridge nearly got in the Premiership as well, you know.
Absolutely. Cambridge were they were close. They were close. John Beck.
That's right.
Was the manager and former Tottenham guy too, and a player. But as a manager, it was Route One. It was extreme of Route One. I mean, I think they even were more so than the crazy gang of Wimbledon. I mean, if you play more than two touches, you're substituted. So it was constantly the goalkeepers as well. There was two goalkeepers there at the time, and they're pretty equal. So what I heard from those guys was that they would decide on who was playing on the Saturday by their striking ability to hit this certain zone on the right flank from the edge of the box. And that's what they did. There was no secrets. They're going to hit Dion Dublin. I think it might have been. Might have been Dion Dublin at the time. They had a bunch of huge strikers and it was just touch, flip, and they just keep turning you over, keep spinning it, just wouldn't let you get a respite. And they let the grass grow long in the corners, put sand in the corners so the ball would get held up.
I remember sand in the corners,
Yeah, and the ball boys all had towels.
Yeah.
And they had a couple boys that could just absolutely launch it in the box, throw it to the near post. I remember conceding one down there where they literally had me wrapped up as I caught the ball. Wrapped up, pulling the ball off, like my arms down. Ball drops to the ground. They bang into the net, and the referee actually allowed it. So a little bit different than you see these days as far as protection goes. But, man, it was effective, really effective, and awful to play against. Awful. I think in that season, I don't think we might have beat them at home just – and then drew away, but
no, yeah. I think we lost. I think we drew at home and lost away. I might be wrong, but I do think.
No, I think you might be right. Yeah, we didn't play them
all the way around. Well. We lost at home and drew away or something. But some good play. Ipswich had some good players. I think Ipswich went that season very underrated, but some very technically gifted as well as strong players. I mean, your defense in front of you, Craig, was it? Frank was there. Was it David Linegan? Neil Thompson.
Yeah, Phil Whelan was there. Neil Thompson.
Yeah.
Tomo's left foot.
Yeah.
Absolute booming. You know, picked up the odd goal for us as well. And actually, he was, you know, you watch it, going back to Neil Thompson, you know, Ederson, the Man City goalkeeper, how he can strike the ball a mile and like gets there quickly. Neil Thompson was that guy.
Yeah.
That's how he struck a ball. I mean, it was amazing how well he struck a ball. But yeah, solid defensively, really good. You know, John Wark as well, just his presence in that side, his confidence, his reading of this game, his dressing room presence, his banter. Everything about John Wark was good, great for us. Mm. It really was. He was a leader that we really needed, and the perfect guy for it too.
He has some good goal scorers as well in Chris Kiwamia and obviously Jason. We mentioned Jason. Jason got quite a few goals. And Paul Goddard as well. Of course, Paul Goddard of England, England International, Newcastle, West Ham, you know, great, great little players. There's some really good technical players there as well.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately for Paul, he was at the end of his career because, excuse me, John Lyle obviously knew him from West Ham, right? Mm. So, and he had some terrific years. So I think he lost that little cutting edge that he used to have. So he never was going to do it at that level for Ipswich, but he was a great addition to the side.
Yeah,
he's exactly. Also a very good leader and great with the younger players as far as development. And that's why he was good at that when he got into that later after his mm-hmm. career too. So yeah, again, more experience in the dressing room and helping that along the way. John Lyle knew the pieces that he always needed, and we needed somebody else to support too, because Chris was really the one we relied on heavily. Although we had some good midfielders too. I mean, Jason was amazing. You know, just, you know, was he 16? I mean, I remember when I was in the U team, so I just arrived and Jason had already scored in the first team because it was at the end of that season before.
Scored on his debut as a, was he 16? Was he
just 16? And then goes to school the next morning.
I went to school next day, yeah.
The next day, right? It's a midweek. And here I show up and I'm like, I can't even imagine them putting me in the first team, you know? Like, I would just, and here it is, like, he's already played in the first team. He made a debut already? This,
And he walked to the ground for the match because he only lived 800 yards away.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, he lived around the corner, didn't he? So he walks to the ground and makes his debut, scores, and probably goes home and has beans on toast by 6 o'clock that evening. He's back home.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, his family and with the history of Ipswich and growing up there, and his brother. I remember his brother. He got into all sorts of trouble because you know, looks like Jason, but basically with red hair, right? Ginger hair. And there was a pitch battle. I can't remember who it was. Maybe against QPR that in mid-80s. And you could see him stand out from a mile away. He's on the pitch, and he's smashing one guy after another, 6'8" or something. Just a massive man, right? Yeah. I was like, oh, boy. He stands out. And next thing you know, sure enough, he's suspended. I don't know how long for. He might have got life for suspension. I don't know. I can't remember.
But I mean, as you say, do you remember winning the league? You obviously, of course you do. Oxford game, the 1-1 game, Oxford, when we clinched. Because I think Town played Grimsby, drew 0-0. I think that was an opportunity missed. And then it was Oxford away. What a day that was. What celebrations.
Yeah. And it was such a small ground then too, right? I don't think we had enough tickets for the amount of, you know, supporters that wanted to go, because that one end zone was again just packed. It was a little bit like South End, you know, just everybody's anticipating the day, and it went well enough where we got the draw. And then, the pitch invasion, and it was probably the perfect place for that, because Oxford, you know, the fans were never gonna, you know, give us any trouble for that. Just let us have some fun, and it was just mayhem. Dressing was great. So,
and of course, the celebrations afterwards. Back, obviously, there was a bus tour and of the town, and you know, it's tremendous, really. What that team did that year. You know, I always think back to, well, I don't think back to, but in 2000, Ipswich won the playoff final at Wembley, which was of course tremendous to get into the Premier League again.
That's right.
What you guys did, that's, you know, 8 years previously. You won it. You didn't. There was no. You didn't have to go to the playoff. I mean, it's really a more extraordinary effort than the Wembley final. Quite rightly, because of the whole magnitude of the day and playing at Wembley, gets all this exposure. And the 92 team, which arguably did it better because they won the damn league by 4 points, I think, over Middlesbrough. They didn't have to worry about playoffs.
I know.
So you had the trip round the Cornhill and round the town, and you remember that, obviously. It's
Yeah. No, but you're right. You're bang on. I think that whole experience, you know, the magnitude of the game in the playoffs at Wembley is, you know, especially now, it's probably the richest game in football.
Yeah.
You know, it's all or nothing. And so obviously, and it's near back in time, but it kind of, because of that, I think it's and the, you know, the trip down there on a particular final almost feels almost greater than actually us winning the division, which is our last trophy or last league title we've won was that year, I believe. So
yeah, exactly, because I mean, yeah, 2000 Ipswich finished third technically, you know, and then went up through the playoffs. But it was a great, don't get me wrong, it was great to win at Wembley, but, you know, just put into context, perhaps, what the 92 team did.
Yeah. You know, and that team, I mean, when you look at Ipswich and how well they did in the Premier League, I think they finished fifth, didn't they?
Yeah.
And then, if I'm not wrong, relegated the next year.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, you can understand where the club were thinking, let's tie this team down, let's get them... Because worst case scenario, we're staying in the Premier League, but this team is capable of doing a lot more than that, as we can see. Then you get caught in relegation, and I don't think the parachute payment was I think it was around, but not nearly what it is now.
No.
And it just absolutely crippled the club.
Yeah.
Crippled it. That's the dangers of it. But you can understand where the club were and why you would want to, you know, get guys tied up on long-term contracts, but you're also expecting that you're going to get the Premier League money. And then when that dries up quickly, it can put you into a tailspin, which it did. And then luckily Ipswich got themselves out of that.
Mm. Of course, it's actually very similar to the 92 situation, wasn't it? Where got into the Premier League, had a few seasons, then got relegated before coming back in again. I mean, what do you remember that time after 92? You know, those few seasons in the Premiership, and you must have enjoyed that.
Oh, it was, you know, every single game, and just, you know, when you're going to the Man Uniteds, and even if the results aren't great, we did actually have some very good results early on. You know, Anfield, we get our first win at Anfield in that time. All the big grounds, you know, the big clubs, the big players standing in the tunnels next to these guys. My idol when I was growing up was Bruce Grobelaar. He was playing for the Vancouver Whitecaps when I was just a young lad. Actually got my picture taken with him in Vancouver. And then he ends up at Liverpool. And long story short, I end up standing in the tunnel next to Bruce Grobelaar going down. And Ian Rush is there and the rest of them. I'm just like, I could hardly contain myself trying to concentrate on, now I actually got to do what I'm doing is trying to get on the pitch in the first place. So I better start doing that. But what an absolute crazy kind of almost twilight zone moment to be next to Bruce Grobelaar doing that.
A long way from that 16-year-old who piped up at St. Leonard's Road in Ipswich that time. And suddenly there you are. It's extraordinary, isn't it? How life is.
Yeah. Yeah, and even, you know, going back that to, you know, and how proud I am to have reached that, at least, you know, the first day before training had started, it was a couple of days before preseason in 84, Steve McCall was in for treatment because he was injured. It was just me and Steve McCall sitting in the dressing room and didn't know me from Adam. Just started chatting. I'm here on trial, and I happened to be sitting underneath Paul Cooper's number 16 squad number for training. And he's like, well, he says, you're sitting there under that. That's where Paul Cooper, our goalkeeper, sits. And he says, if you ever get a chance to sit underneath that, you'll have done something pretty special.
Yeah.
And so that was always my goal, to be underneath
number
16, you know.
Oh, terrific.
And there's a lot of ups and downs along the way, and some of them good, some of them bad. But yeah, that was it's not lost on me, that's for sure.
Now, talking about good ups and downs, we have to mention some downs as well as some ups, Craig. And of course, unfortunately, you were I was working that day on the. Do you remember the Greenan newspaper that used to come out on Saturday?
Of course.
Of course, the Greenan. Yeah, I was working on the Greenan that day when
I got probably 1,000 clips of those from.
Ah, fantastic! Good, excellent, excellent. Yeah, well, terrific paper. And unfortunately, Manchester United 9, Ipswich Town 0, unfortunately occurred now. You've probably talked about this enough times, and you really are fed up of talking about it. But I mean, you had so many good times. We have to mention a bit of a bummer. What a day.
Well, I have no time. I have no issues talking about it. It was crazy. I mean, John Lyle had been fired not that long. George Bird took over. The club was definitely in a free fall. Confidence was gone. Had a few injuries. We were getting beaten up pretty badly. And then you throw in the fact that Man United were neck and neck with Blackburn at the time, and goal differential could come into play. So where you usually get teams 5-6 up, there you keep the ball. You're not searching for more goals. If you get them, fine, but you're not searching for them. You don't want to get any more injuries. The job is done. But to add more goals on the goal differential, Ferguson was just keep piling it on, just keep going. He's encouraging it. And I knew exactly what he was doing. Yeah. And I don't blame him for it. But when you're up against Lambs to the Slaughter at that time, it was very difficult to get the guys to get out of this fog, that just seemed to last for 3 days. The game just would not end. And then also there's a couple of things. I mean, I think, George, looking back on it, Burley, he would have, taken a different approach to it. The pre-match chat was about them not expecting us to attack.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough.
And as you could tell, it caught him off guard. We were very surprised.
Yeah. You certainly did that all right, Miss Sam.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were pushed up, way too high, squeezing up on the halfway line with some of the fastest players in the league. Frankie was fast, but Giggsy was just flying. And then they bring on substitutes as well that are just world class, and just kept coming and coming. Andy Cole. I mean, really most of Andy Cole. I mean, he scored 5, but I think a lot of other, it wasn't like there was a bunch of worldies, it was a lot of rebounds, crossbar goal, I'd save it goal, in the end, I actually was surprised. I was like, oh, he actually got 5 of them, did he? But the only good thing about it was, I actually thought it was 10 when I thought, oh, really? I thought it was 10. I talk about fog. I was all fogged up. I was ready to lose it. And then when I saw Graham Pohl, the referee, almost running with the players celebrating. I mean, that guy was having more fun than the Man U players, the referee. Freaking guy. He was so arrogant, that guy.
but look, let's forget that, because despite for about 25 years, us Ipswich Town fans having to sort of hope and pray somebody was to get 9. But as you say, when people were getting 5, 6, or 7s, we're all like, come on, come on. And they would just play keep ball because no one was bothered after I got 6 or 7.
But that's fortunately, true.
Fortunately, that's... Southampton helped us out. I mean, and they did just help us out once. They've helped us out twice. So
yeah, that's right. And you do have a few teams like Man City, for instance. Pep, he won't stop. He won't stop. He'll keep going, But you're right. A lot, you won't see that a lot. But I mean, for years and years, I covered the Premier League for 18 years on TV here as well, and social media. Yeah. If I'm watching a game's at 4-0 at after half an hour, 5-0 at half. It's like it's the 9-0 watch, right? Yeah. So I know what's happening, even if I'm not watching it. Like a phone's going crazy, and then for the longest time, it just, 7, 8, I just didn't quite get there.
In the office, we used to have to be on standby when it got to that exact stage where someone had suddenly scored 4 in half an hour. We used to get phone calls saying it could be tonight, it could be tonight, and we had to sit there get the story ready that the 9-0 has eventually been beaten.
Code red. Code red.
Code red. Yeah, it's a bit code red. Yeah. But anyway, that's by the by. Southampton have sorted that out. So,
yeah.
more cheerful times and happier memories, Craig. And you know, we've talked about the 92s. And by the way, I hope you're Kings of Anglia listeners and viewers, I hope you're enjoying listening to, well, not myself particularly, but certainly listen to Craig Forrest here on the Kings of Anglia podcast. It's great to have him here always live from Canada with his Ipswich Town shirts in the background. So that's great. But Canada, let's talk about Canada, Craig. 56 caps. I mean, wow, congratulations. I mean, that's a tremendous achievement. You must be thrilled. That's a tremendous honor to represent your country so many times.
Yeah, it was. It was a lot of fun. It wasn't always ideal, even going back to prior to the FIFA break and prior to the FIFA rule that clubs would have to allow you to leave. Clubs could stop you from going. So as disappointed as I was as a teenager when I wasn't even recognized by the Canadian Soccer Association when I was in Ipswich already for 2 years, very backward association in the first place. We're going into the World Cup for the first time, and you know, Bobby Ferguson and Charlie Woods and guys like Brian Owen, they were calling the Canadian Soccer Association, like, you know, you should be, what are you doing? Like, your goalkeepers aren't at this level.
Yeah.
And they completely ignored me, absolutely ignored me. So I was really disappointed that I wasn't at least part of that 86 World Cup team. Mm. So, and then the following year, they asked if I would play. They had qualified for the under 20 World Cup. So I played in that in Chile in 1987. It was interesting because my parents were actually on a holiday in Ipswich and I was in Chile. And during that time was the massive storm in Ipswich. Remember that storm?
Oh, yeah, of course I do. Yeah, but yes, the trees blew down everywhere. The hurricane. Yep.
The hurricane. Right. So my parents were in the backyard in a caravan of the Trenters, you know, Phil Trenters sent me over. So they became good friends. They were staying in their caravan in the back. And my dad said he looked out the window because he was just crazy. And he said the apple tree in the back of the yard just spinning in circles and off it went. So they figured, I think we should go inside. You know, nobody expected anything like that, right? So anyway, so we were in Chile for that. And then I made my full international debut in the summer of 88. They had a Three Nations tournament between Greece, Chile, and Canada, called the Sir Stanley Matthews Cup. Because Sir Stanley Matthews lived in Toronto and actually played over here later in his career as well. So he was highly thought of, obviously very highly respected. So they named a little tournament after him. So that's how I made my Canadian debut.
Now, CONCACAF in 2000, which Canada won. Now, according to my details here, you were the best player, the most valuable player, the most valuable goalkeeper, and you were selected in the best 11. It sounds like you single-handedly sort of won it for Canada. I'm sure you didn't, but it's quite an impressive little lineup there, Craig.
Yeah, I was busy. I was really busy. I think things went very well. Yeah, things went really well. Very well. Even Paolo Wanchope was playing for Costa Rica. That was in the earlier rounds. He was my teammate at West Ham at the time, and then just, you know, to manage to play that and then get through Mexico and, you know, to win something that big was something I never expected. I love playing for Canada. I love the guys. I love getting together. We were always the national team that nobody cared about. Like, and I mean that respectively, but we don't have any traveling fans. We bring nothing to the game. Like, if we qualify for the World Cup now, a little different. But back then, we're not bringing much to the party. If Mexico don't make the World Cup, that's a big deal in 94. Yeah. That's a really big deal. Mm. So we finished actually in 94 qualifying. We finished second in CONCACAF, and it gave us it gave us a quarter spot. There's only 1.25 spots available for 94 from our region. The Americans obviously took one of the automatic because they're hosting. Yeah. We had Mexico tied on points going to the last game, and we needed to win because their goal differential was better. Azteca, they would just clean house with everybody. Mm-hmm. And we went 1-0 up, and it was a great game, very, very tight, but we ended up losing it 2-1 late. So our quarter spot was Australia home and away, which we did very well and should have won that comfortably, but ended up losing on penalty shootouts in Sydney.
Oh, gosh.
But, yeah. But if we had beaten them, it wasn't like, no, you're not in the World Cup yet. Now you've got to go to Argentina and play Diego Maradona home and away. And then if you win, you're in. So we figured once we lost to Mexico, that was
a relief.
It's going to be pretty tough. Also, yeah. Australia did really well. They only lost 1-0 on aggregate too, on a really fluky goal in Buenos Aires. So, but yeah, so we, what I wish we had to get like is what we had now is with 3.5 spots. Because then we would have qualified and quite rightly so in 1994. But I remember mentioning about the rule changes. John Duncan, I'd just been in the team not for very long, and I was asked to go to play in the qualifyings for 1990. It was a pre-qualifying round, pretty straightforward, should be, against Guatemala. Home and away, you go into the final group. John Duncan said, I'm not going to stop you from going. If you want to go, you can go. It's an amazing experience. You're playing for your country. But I'm going to be honest with you. We have good goalkeepers here. I can't remember who was at the time, whether it was even Clive Baker or Ron Fearon or whoever. But if they go in and do well, I can't give you your spot back. You're going to lose your position, just so you know. But if you decide that you don't want to go and keep your position here, to take the pressure off you, I will tell Canada that I will not let you go. So he put it on him, as opposed to knowing that it would be putting some pressure on me if I said, no, I'm not going because I want to stay here because I just got into the team. And so, and that's exactly why I didn't actually end up there. John Duncan said I wasn't allowed to go, but that wasn't actually true.
No,
exactly. But exactly. He was also telling me the truth that,
well, of course, you moved on to West Ham as after Ipswich, Craig. And you had a little spell there, and a good little spell there. And you enjoy West Ham.
I did enjoy West Ham. I did. I mean, from a footballing standpoint, I could have easily played my another 5 years at Ipswich, 18 years up to 20 years at Ipswich, and been completely happy, more than happy. But then getting the move to West Ham and just playing in London, playing for East End team like West Ham, and that culture being quite different from Ipswich, it was a great experience. So I put it down to just another experience of another football club that was run a little bit differently. The fans were different. Harry Redknapp was sideways, just entertainment all the time. The squad was incredible with Razor Ruddock, DiCanio, John Moncur, Trevor Sinclair, Steve Lomas, Rio Ferdinand, Michael Carrick, Glenn Johnson. I mean, unbelievable squad. So we did do well in that too. So the 5 years I was there, we were in the top 10 in the Premier League every year. Yeah. So it was hard not to enjoy yourself. And my teammates, my goalkeepers, James was there. Shaka ended up coming, Shaka Hislop, just a terrific guy. Ludic McCloskey was there when I arrived. Fantastic guy. So we've been really good friends and not close contact, but always kept in touch with each other over the years. We've had a great relationship between ourselves.
Brilliant. Well, look, we've got to come to the end soon of the podcast, Craig. It's been fantastic talking to you. But look, what are we up to today then? So, I mean, I know you're doing a lot of media work and you've been doing a lot of you probably teach us how to do podcasts. You've been doing play podcasts yourselves. And
Started doing a podcast just prior to the pandemic, or maybe when it just started, just almost a reason to get together and, at least socialize in some sort of form. Right. And we could get together in at a location too, at certain stages, depending on the restrictions and whatever at the time. And the reason why we did it is we had recently lost rights to the Premier League from a television standpoint. So we were let go from that TV station that I was at for nearly 20 years. And so we see this changing media concept, the whole, how is it working? You guys are noticing this. We're doing a podcast for the East Anglia. Like, this is, you still have to be creative in figuring out ways to get content and media out there. It's because people aren't going physically and buying newspapers is the same. You know, it's just, it's changed. You know it as well as anybody. It's incredibly difficult for writers. Yeah. How do writers make a living these days? And, you know, everybody with a Twitter handle is now a journalist, you know. It's the challenges of it. It's great that you can actually compete sometimes against the big brands. If you do a really good job and you have good guests and you have good conversations, and I think we did that. So about four or five of us with some experience in broadcasting have taken on the likes of ESPN and in the football realms and some of the top podcasts. And so for the most part, we're the top podcast, soccer podcast in Canada. What that means, not an awful lot, but the fact that we're ahead of ESPN and some of the BBC ones even, and that whatever, so it's we must be doing something right. So it's a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun. And we did, and we're just trying to sort of mostly promote and a little bit educate some of the new soccer fans in Canada, because our national team are doing so well. People are jumping on the bandwagon, but they don't have any idea about history or how did we get here or all these different things. So we interview past players, past board members, you know, even guys over in England, Trevor Sinclair and Lomas, and all of that. Yeah. So we, all that kind of thing, you know, how it works. And it's really fun. I really enjoy it. And doing podcasts like this, it gives you a chance to give you more than a 30-second soundbite to try to explain something. Like, okay, you got 30 seconds. Tell us about your career in Ipswich, you know?
Yeah.
So, you can really hash things out, and it's real. And I think people will really feel that, and it's a habit-changing thing. But once people change their habits, we see this type of thing growing all the time. So thanks a lot, Mike, and all the very best with it. And
it's an absolute pleasure, an absolute pleasure. Do you still follow – are you following Ipswich's how they get on? Do you still look out for them?
I do, of course. A little bit harder – DAZN have the championship, and then when they got hooked, I was like, oh, now, like, it's hard to see coverage of them over here,
of course.
Right? And the further they drop down the pecking order,
well, hopefully, we're all hoping they might slightly have just be turning the corner slightly up and got a new manager, and maybe hopefully things will be turning up. But, Craig, if you had to look back at a few moments in time, particularly at Ipswich, I suppose, what would they be? I mean, what would you, a few moments at Ipswich, that 92 season or other times?
You know, I'd have to say the biggest and the best things about it were being able to come through generations and meet guys and be trained with Paul Cooper and Terry Butcher and George Burley and meet guys and know their history, like Alan Brazil, and on and on it went. And then to play with the guys and the relationships that you build, the Neil Thompsons, the Frank Yallops, you know, Dave Linigans, and Chris Kawamia come over here, Jason Dizell. These are all the things that you remember more than actually games or moments. Other than that, I would just say every single time I walked on the pitch for Ipswich, especially in the top flight, was an absolute honor. Absolute honor. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Craig. It's been an absolute honor to talk to you, if you don't mind me saying. I mean, it's, you know, as I said, Ipswich Town, you know, they've won some trophies, not a huge amount, but, you know, that 92 season was a terrific effort to get back into the inaugural Premiership. It really was. And it's great to see you from Canada with your shirts and everything. That's what I like to see. That's like top man. Craig, thank you ever so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And I'm sure Ipswich fans will have appreciated listening to you. Good luck with everything. And good luck with that podcast. Don't do too well, though. You mustn't take over Kings of Anglia podcast.
But I doubt it, but...
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
From true crime to football, Brexit to football. For more great podcasts from Archon, head to audioboom.com/channel/Archon. Archon, head to audioboom.com/channel/Archon.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.